Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, crisis, culture, and civility, critical media literacy education, and election 2024. I recently led a roundtable conversation with media scholars Allison Butler, Nolan Higdon, and Sydney Sullivan. We talk about why we need critical media literacy education in the United States and how it contributes to more meaningful civic engagement. This program is also part of a special big rhetorical podcast carnival looking at politics and rhetorics navigating civility, culture, and crisis. Stay tuned for a Project Censored show on critical media literacy for election 2024. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, Crisis, Culture, and Civility, Critical Media Literacy Education, and Election 2024. Listeners to the program know that we've been addressing this issue quite a lot the past several months. The reasons are obvious. But our angle looking at the importance of critical media literacy education is one that I think that I certainly wish would catch on in broader media circles. And I know today's expert panelists would agree. We are joined by Allison Butler. Allison is a senior lecturer and director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program, the Department of Communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is also co-director of Mass Media Literacy Nonprofit Organization, where she develops and runs training programs for teachers covering critical media literacy in K-12 schools. And Allison Butler, welcome to the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is wonderful to have you. And also, we're joined by Nolan Higdon, founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. He's a Project Censored national judge, author, and lecturer at the Merrill College in the Education Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. His work's available at his Substack, nolanhigdon.substack.com, and he is author and co-author of numerous books, including The Anatomy of Fake News, A Critical News Literacy Education, Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy, The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People, and also Surveillance Education, Navigating the Conspicuous Absence of Privacy in Schools, and of course, you've heard him here before many, many times on the Project Censored Show. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the program.
What's up, Mickey? Thanks for having me.
And I would love to welcome also Sydney Sullivan, who is a full-time lecturer at San Diego State University, is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Davis. Sydney, we're delighted to have you here with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mickey. I'm happy to be here.
Speaking of being well-informed in day-to-day lives, and we hope that that leads to people being meaningfully civically engaged, we're going to divide our conversation today into a few components. First, we're going to talk about the crisis. We don't just have a civic crisis. It's also been brought on by a media crisis, and actually a media literacy crisis. We have a dearth of media literacy education in the United States. All present company accepted, naturally. But here we are in the same space talking about it. And as I mentioned earlier, it would be wonderful if the kinds of conversations that we're going to have today would make their way into broader educational arenas and even into the political landscape. It would be wonderful to hear our political candidates talking about the importance of many of these issues. So we're going to talk about crisis, how we got here. And we'll start with you, Nolan Higdon, and go through Allison and Sydney. And then we're going to talk also about culture. We're going to talk about some specific examples of things that are happening around us and how critical media literacy education maybe can help us navigate some of those issues. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the importance of civility. While not being a requirement for the First Amendment, civility is a really important component when we're communicating with each other, especially reaching across aisles to people who may be different than each other, and particularly if there are impasses or if there are significant disagreements. I'm imagining some people in the audience might be rolling their eyes or laughing somewhat cynically because we live in a very hyper-partisan climate right now, being driven by a lot of heated rhetoric. We might even say hateful rhetoric at times. But this has been a while in the making, and we've all written about this to varying degrees. So Nolan Higdon, let's start with you about some of the crisis that we're facing, because you're the author of a book about fake news, and we can't seem to get rid of the term, let alone the practice. I mean, after the 2016 election, we kind of saw ourselves erupt into a moral panic around fake news and what we need to do about it. But yet here we are in the midst of an election where we're not even, we're on the cusp here of yet another major election. And we see major candidates talking about immigrants eating dogs and cats and pets and other completely bogus stories driven by racism that somehow just seem to take hold in the electorate. Nolan Higdon, can you talk a little bit about this challenge? And of course, as ever, we'll come back to critical media literacy education as the antidote for these issues. Nolan Higdon, we'll start with you.
Yeah, thank you, Mickey. Yeah, and well said. Fake news has been a fixation point to explain all our problems for the last decade or so, which has led to a litany of problems. But from a critical media literacy perspective, media itself isn't necessarily the problem. It depends what we do with our media, kind of defines its role. And in the United States, we've allowed a lot of our media to become for profit, and so it operates for that profit. And as a result, these companies, media makers, try and transform users from media citizens to media consumers, basically mindless consumers that can use these for the profit-making purposes. So right there, we have a lack of focus for democracy in our media system. I'm talking about both our news media and our so-called social media. But even worse than that, and I think this gets to the layer of the hyper-partisanship you were talking about. The ways in which these tools are designed really feed into spreading false information and dividing audiences. So news media and journalism for about 30 years now have really switched their programming to be a us versus them mentality, a confirmation bias type reporting, where audiences go to be told they're right and get an opportunity to lampoon a character of the other side. That started with cable news. The legacy newspapers got involved in doing the same model once they went to a subscriber model in the digital age. And of course, social media, study after study shows that falsehood flies further and faster than truth on social media. And the best content on social media, best in terms of engagement, is that which divides, appeals to hate and fear, or confirms bias, which is exactly what effective fake news does. So while fake news is a problem in the fact that people believe it and act in horrible ways on it, we do have a media system, though, that amplifies it and privileges it over truth. And that's a critical part as well, because one of the great areas of frustration, and I think my co-panelists here will agree with this, is that we've tried to always reduce the fake news problem down to individuals. So it's an Alex Jones problem, it's a Russia problem, it's a Trump problem. We never focus on the tools that are allowing fake news to spread further and faster. Those oligarchs and big tech never seem to get the blame. It's always us poor users who are using their devices incorrectly. So I think that kind of sums up where we are. You see, after 30 years of getting bombarded with hyperpartisan media messages that are reinforced with social media algorithms, we no longer have any faith we can talk to each other. And so you hear people constantly say they're afraid of the other side, or they're tired of putting up with the other side. But if you really start interrogating, most people don't actually put up with the other side. They block their people out online, they censor people online, and they know a character of the other side they get from 24-hour news networks. So it's not even that we refuse to talk to each other. We really don't even know each other at some level, which makes it really difficult to have a democracy.
Indeed. And Nolan Higdon, this has obviously contributed to a lack of trust that we see. It's pervasive among many of our public and private institutions. But trust in media, this is from an October 21st Gallup poll posted from All Sides Media. We can maybe talk about them later too. But the recent trust in media survey here says, in general, how much trust and confidence do you have in mass media, newspapers, TV, radio? When it comes to reporting the news fully, accurately, and fairly, a great deal, a fair amount, not very much, or not at all. Well, we won't keep you waiting and guessing about the numbers, but a great deal is 8%. A fair amount is 23%. Not very much, 33%. None at all, 36%. The great deal, fair amount number of 31%. That's again That's very troubling. And again, we see media now falling below Congress in trust surveys. 69% of Americans will not relieve themselves on a journalist in flames, is what independent journalist Matt Taibbi said. Of course, some critics and media would actually blame him for some of the problems, but that's another matter. Allison Butler, let's bring you in here on the heels of that wonderful news. Let's talk about the crisis, and what's your angle on this?
I get it. I understand it, and it makes me really sad. And I would say that that might be part of the problem. And so I include myself in the problem. We might not have much trust in our mainstream media, and maybe they don't deserve much trust, but we still seek it out. We're still looking at it. We're still trying to find information from somewhere. So we get kind of caught ourselves as individuals, as families, as community members in, I don't know if this is the right metaphor, but kind of in this eye of the storm where we want to know what's happening in our world, but we don't necessarily trust the institutions that are telling us that. To Nolan's point, these things that are presented as individual problems, we get invited to look at the individual, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But when we're looking at the individual, if we think of it as a question of framing and we're only looking at that individual, what are we not invited to look at? What are we being restricted from looking at? So we're not looking at the systems. We're not looking at the structures. And I think we're getting lulled these days, and probably broader than these days. I hate to do generational arguments, but I'm going to do one for just a moment here in the spirit of all of this stuff feeling so contradictory. When we look at what young people say about getting their news, they're getting their news, or self-identified getting news, from social media. Social media aren't news sites. Yes, there might be the opportunity to share news and information, but TikTok is not a news site. Instagram is not a news site. And yet we hear an X or Twitter or whatever we want to call it, not a news site. But what we're hearing is that folks scroll through these, and that's where they're getting their news and their information, which means they're getting the tiniest bit of a tiny bit of information. That's not being fully informed, but it is next to impossible these days to be fully informed. So I'd say part of the crisis is when we are getting our news online from quote unquote legitimate or quote unquote illegitimate sources, we are already in a nice warm echo chamber that tells us what we already believe. So I could be a person that is trying to learn more about the world, trying to understand what is going on. And because of the data pathway that I've been on, I'm only going to know more about the world that I already agree with. So I will falsely feel that I am informed. And then when there's something that happens in the world that counteracts that, I will feel maybe that my news outlet has lied to me, has misinformed me, and I will not trust it. But to break out of that feels impossible. So we get kind of caught up in this. And I think it engenders a fair amount of self-blame, like, oh, I did something wrong. Well, did I? Maybe I did. That's entirely possible. But also, was I directed in a way through the way these systems are organized that kept me from learning what else I could learn?
The phenomenon that you just described, Allison Butler, we wrote about in the recent Project Censored book from this past year, called news snacking. And what you talked about is the scrolling, like the news will find me. And what you described with the algorithms and the confirmation bias, that's one problem we have in social media for sure. But this challenge, I think, as you were suggesting, it predates social media. People learn certain habits and behaviors, and they go to their, what they were taught was the right source or the trusted source. You know, you could trust the New York Times to have side A and B or what have you. And there'd be differences on editorials or what have you from different papers. But it seems like we've always had this kind of a challenge, but it's really been exacerbated in many ways by the technology, number one. And number two, I'm assuming you would agree with this, a lack of critical media literacy education to keep up with the times.
That's part of it, is we are so inundated and have been for generations and have been for decades and eons. I don't want to say that we're just inundated today. We have always been told and given the narrative that this new technology is now inundating us. We were told this when film was first invented and popularized, that we were on a moral decline in society because the movies were going to teach us bad things. And I think the worst that was happening at that time might have been a well-turned ankle, you know, rising out of a not lengthy enough skirt. But what we have never done in full capacity is counteract that moral decline with critical media literacy education.
Yeah, a very significant point, and a good point to bring you, Sydney Sullivan, bring you into the conversation and to hear your angle a little bit about the crisis in media. And then, of course, we're going to move through these several other portions of our conversation. But Sydney Sullivan.
Yeah, when I think about the crisis, I think I draw pretty strongly onto the student population. Nolan was talking earlier about blocking people online, not knowing one another. And I can feel that to be extremely true when it comes to the classroom space. And I can feel that shift in the classroom space when we talk about heated arguments or political arguments, that they really struggle to have these conversations with one another. I think that struggle comes from a few things, whether it's scared of being canceled or scared of disagreeing with one another. But I think more than anything, it's this idea of being shamed or canceled. And I don't think people are really able to have those conversations anymore, which is frustrating and difficult. So I think creating those spaces for students is really critical. But I think the crisis also comes from this idea of just students being kind of separated from one another as well. When they have these different political ideas, political values, they're having those echo chambers where they're not really able to have conversations with one another. And I think something that I noticed the most, especially in my first year classrooms, so usually we have traditionally students 18 to 25, is that the idea of verifying their information or having information that they see as valid isn't a skill set which has been solidified over time. So a lot of times I'll get papers or submissions of things that are like, well, this is fact. And I'm like, well, where did you get this? And I think that's something that they struggle with, is actually verifying information or knowing where that information is coming from. So that's something I see as a gap in the classroom that I'm always trying to encourage them to fill, is thinking about rhetoric, but then also thinking about things really critically, like why is someone getting you or wanting you to feel this way is always what I'm trying to come back to. Why is a company, why is an author, why are they wanting you to feel this way? And what is the purpose of the message that they're sending you? And so through that, we really have deeper conversations about what it means to create messages, what it means to receive them, and what it is that people are wanting out of students. And so I think that can be really helpful. But again, it's very frustrating because there is a sense of not wanting to be canceled, not wanting to be in conflict. Students, I think, are very nervous and scared around one another. And so that can be a really difficult thing to be able to navigate in the classroom. And I think that's where well-being for me became a center point, is thinking about when we have these conversations, when we deal with these kinds of issues, how can we centralize your well-being and others' well-being as well?
That seems to be a crucial component as part of the educational process. We heard from Nolan about news declining trust, the problems of fake news. Allison, you continued talking about the challenges of social media, biases, lack of awareness of sources, and so on. And now, Sydney, you're taking it to another level. And around all of this, there's also a crisis of communication. There's, dare one say, in this vast sea of communications technology, there's a dearth of actual communication happening. It's very perplexing. And the idea of centering it around well-being, that applies to conflict management, how we talk to one another, active listening. We'll talk more about some of that later. It goes into civility. But that's an extraordinary component that we often don't hear. You know, when we hear conversations about media literacy, I don't always hear that part of it. Could you expand on some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what my dissertation researches on. It actually went across all of the UC system and focused on classes that encompass critical media literacy. But then I went in and said, do you have a focus on well-being? And if not, how can we integrate this in? And so it's really kind of trying to see where's the missing component here. And does this component really add to the classroom space? Are we able to kind of implement this in a way that can be beneficial for our students? And I think what you're talking about, Mickey, empathy for me is a big one, a key component where in order to be able to understand another person, I think you do need to be able to have empathy for what they're saying, empathy for being able to get on the same knowledge as them, and then also understanding where they're coming from. And so I think that's a huge component that I focus on in the research is how can we be able to centralize this? And is this something that people are doing? What I found across a lot of the campuses and then a lot of the courses is that it wasn't a center point, but it was something that people were having these topics come up that could have used a center point of well-being because they were discussing things that were difficult conversations or discussions that people struggled or students struggled with in the classroom.
That's Sydney Sullivan. We're also joined by Nolan Higdon and Allison Butler. The Project Censor Show today is looking at crisis culture and civility, critical media literacy education. We're doing that on the backdrop, of course, of election 2024. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'd like to remind you, you are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're going to continue our conversation after this brief musical break, where we'll turn to examples of many of the things that our esteemed panelists were just discussing as we move into our political cultures. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today, we're looking at crisis culture and civility, critical media literacy education on the backdrop of election 2024. And believe it or not, we will get to the civility portion of the program, I promise. But before, we need to get into the weeds of culture. My goodness, this could go many different directions, but you all pretty great examples of things where you'd like to focus on parts of our political culture. Again, an extension of what we were just defining as the crisis, some of the challenges that we're facing. Always, again, mindful of where we're heading here with some possible solutions, way of doing things differently. Certainly, one of our expert panelists, Sydney Sullivan, just talked about centering well-being. Very important. I'd like to reintroduce our panelist, Nolan Higdon, media scholar, founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, Project Censored National Judge, author of numerous books on media literacy. Allison Butler is senior lecturer and director of Media Literacy Certificate Program, Department of Communications at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And Sydney Sullivan's a full-time lecturer at San Diego State University, a PhD candidate, University of California, Davis, focusing on education and digital rhetoric with an emphasis on well-being. Well, let's jump back in. And Nolan, let's go back to you and let's talk about some of the examples that we see going around in our culture, in our political culture in particular. And perhaps you can help us look at it through a critical media literacy lens and help our listeners maybe see something different.
One of the things we've noticed, particularly in this election cycle, are two newer developments that I think are interesting about the culture. One is the proliferation of deep fakes. I think this has been the first election really dominated by those. There have been quite convincing photos of things like Donald Trump rescuing people during the hurricane or praying in like a religious light or Kamala Harris giving speech to a Soviet style audience in a Soviet style stadium. They even had deep fake of her holding communist papers that were false too. So there's been some really convincing deepfakes. The reason why I say that that's kind of critical to the culture right now is American culture moves fast and always moving in this sort of gig economy mentality, seeing as believing, those types of phrases. Well, that's just simply not true in the age of AI. It really necessitates why we need a cultural shift on slowing down because so many of these videos and audio clips and visuals are so convincing. But we got to take time to do a deeper look into them before we react. So I think that's one cultural shift for media lens I've noticed. Then another one, and I think this is more of a optimistic space, although I do have some questions about where it's going to go. I think podcasting has finally established its role in American democracy and in a big way during this election. You've seen Kamala Harris went on the Call Her Daddy podcast. Donald Trump has been on Theo Vaughn and Andrew Schultz. And it appears that both candidates are rumored to be going on Joe Rogan as well. And this is a time when legacy media audiences for some, like CNN, have been chopped in half since Trump left office. And these new media spaces are growing in popularity. Got to give somewhat credit to Donald Trump here. About 8 years ago, he recognized the power of this space and was really responsible for helping him in the Electoral College, where a lot of establishment news outlets were sort of shocked by the things Trump was saying and doing. It was hitting well in the new media space, and they were just too out of touch with that space to recognize it. And I think Harris is starting to pick up on that as well. So I don't know where that means as a cultural shift. I say it's positive because you're able to break the corporate news frame by having the popularity of these podcasts. But these are still on corporate platforms that could and have gotten rid of certain voices. So that's a threat I think we need to be concerned about with the culture. And more importantly, if we're talking about, and that's where this conversation began, about how fragmented our audiences are, the podcast world is pretty fragmented. People go to a handful of podcasts. The audiences are large by a podcaster's standards, but not like a large, significant part of the electorate for that particular podcast. And so it may also symbolize the further fragmenting of audiences, which we've already established is problematic for a democracy. So I think those are two major parts of the culture I've seen in this election that are catching my attention.
Well, Nolan Higdon, just to remind our listeners, you're also a co-author of a book called The Podcaster's Dilemma. Now, Allison Butler, you mentioned this earlier about the various moral panics around new technologies when you were talking about the advent of film and how we were all going to go to hell in a handbasket because of what was happening in movies and radio in the War of the Worlds. Well, even that whole story was blown out of proportion. Nevertheless, there's been these conflicts in the media spaces, which is, I think, pretty significant. And I think that that's what's happening. We're seeing that happening where podcasting's been around long enough that there are definitely corners of it that are now seen as completely part of the media ecosystem. Yet there's still pot shots taken in the last couple years. Joe Rogan is not the best example, but he's a good example for someone that had high numbers, big audience. And so the bigger the audience, the more they attract the ire of the establishment or the traditional legacy media outlets. He was getting 11, 12 million people a week. Fox is getting what? Maybe a couple million at best. And they're one of the top cable networks. And look, as you just said, Nolan Higdon, in the numbers game of the electorate, how many people live in this country? 330 million people. And we're talking about audiences of 1 or 2 million or 12 million. I mean, I think there's some other issues here that maybe we should look at. And just how easily are the agendas set by these smaller groups of people? But Allison Butler, let's bring you back in to talk about your angle on some of the things that we're seeing in the political culture. And I know that these are some themes that you've written about at length.
To add on to what Nolan was talking about, two other significant moments that I think need to be addressed and in some ways are absolutely being ignored and in some ways are being danced around. You know, there was a lot of talk prior to July 21 about the age of the two candidates running for president, particularly Joe Biden. And the framing was on how he was an incompetent old man. As soon as it was Kamala Harris, age was done being a conversation for either candidate. We weren't talking about anybody's age. But I think what we forget about when we talk about age, particularly as I was saying before about framing, is that we aren't talking about young voters. Young voters are left out of the conversation. When we look at the platforms, when we look at these hyper-individualized platforms, we're looking at things, with all due respect to myself, that are important to middle-aged people. When we're talking about jobs and we're talking about the economy and we're talking about even the conversations about student debt and we're talking about immigration and we're talking about global wars, we are talking about middle-aged people. And yet, both candidates want to capture the youth vote. Taylor Swift might have done her part in getting 18-year-olds to vote as a childless cat lady, but none of the conversations about the election have anything to do with our young voters. When we're talking about student debt, we're talking about folks who have already graduated from college. Maybe we're thinking to some extent about folks who are about to go to college. But when we get upset as a population about how kids these days aren't paying attention to current events, no kidding, current events isn't paying attention to them. It's not surprising that they would prefer scrolling through Instagram or TikTok for fun stuff. What do they care about Medicare and Medicaid? It's practically a foreign language. So I think as the maelstrom of this election, I cannot follow my own advice and I am obsessively looking at things. But it is the reminder that our focus on age might have gone in the wrong direction in one point. And then the other thing that I think is really important is the gender conversation. Both the fact that we have a woman of color with a pretty viable chance to become president. So the second person of color and the first woman of color. But I think the conversation that isn't being had enough about that, and Kamala Harris is really not pointing out her gender. She sort of lets other people do that. How she can be both praised and blamed simultaneously in one single act for being a woman. Whatever she does, she's just doing that because she's a woman. She's just getting away with this because she's a woman. But then the same act can be like, oh, thank goodness a woman is thinking about that. So I think we have a further illustration about how absolutely are divided our country, if not our entire globe, is about understanding the compartments in which gender issues are supposed to fit. Whatever she's doing is too much or too little. And I think about the gun, right? The fact that she said that she had a Glock and that she has shot it. Sure, that is surprising for a Democratic candidate. We tend to think of the Democrats as more about gun control. But I think part of our surprise with that is that we also have a lady gun owner.
The other thing too, Alison Butler, is a lack of the media's attention at looking at Harris's actual background in California and being a really law and order kind of candidate and was really in with the police. I mean, I'd be shocked if she didn't have many guns, to be honest. People that are DAs or in law enforcement, they have a different association with culture, but it doesn't fit into the neat blocks.
She leaned real far away from that in the 2020. When she was running in 2020 in that super crowded field, she leaned really, really far away from that. In 2024, when facing a convicted felon as her opponent, she's leaning real hard into the law and order. And I think as a nation, we tend to have difficulty with law and order women. We aren't surprised by it. We don't look askance at it when we have law and order men, but when we have law and order women, we look at them differently. And she is leaning hard into that right now.
Another double standard. Who would have thought? You know, when Alison Butler, I'm reminded, of course, of a couple of great pieces you wrote not too long ago that kind of couple the issues you just brought up, age and gender. When you were writing about the ludicrous remarks of Don Lemon over at CNN and Nikki Haley being, quote, past her prime.
A nice euphemism for menopause.
That's pretty striking. We had two other people at the time, Trump and Biden. Somehow there is no prime.
At least as far as the narrative goes, men are never past their prime. They are perpetually in their prime. Every age is a great age to be a man. Every age is not a great age to be a woman.
Can I add something else to that too? That just thinking about media literacy in that segment with Don Lemon that rarely gets talked about, when his co-host pushed him back on how ignorant it is to say women are past his prime, his response was, go ahead and Google it. And I just found it hilarious that someone in news media would actually tell an audience, oh, you don't know something? Just go to Google. It'll tell you what it is.
And his follow-up to that was, I'm just saying what the facts are. Which, by the way, you can learn from Google, so I suppose we don't need to watch your show anymore.
Sydney Sullivan, let's bring you in, and let's look at your angle on culture and critical media literacy education.
I was just thinking about a lot of the things Allison said, especially when it came to gender, to age. Something that I pull in with my students a lot is the bias of AI. So DALL-E, for example, which is like an image creating platform, always creates images that are gender and age biased. So in one of the examples, the women in the samples were never aged. They always had like a young appearance. They couldn't have wrinkles. They needed to have this kind of youthful selves to them. And it was based on a generated prompt to do someone in the workforce. So they were kind of insinuating women who work need to be this like young, vibrant person. And so we talk a lot in the classroom about this idea of like age and gender and what it looks like to be a woman in the workforce. Allison, when she was talking about Harris, also reminded me, Harris for me was the first person I ever saw to have really aggressively sexual reimaginings, drawings, AI of them. And that was something that I noticed within the social media sphere that I was really disturbed by, frustrated by, that I'd never seen for any men who came into politics. And so that was something that I had noticed and had brought kind of as a topic into different spaces, whether that was in my student space or when I was in the classroom with others trying to really understand like what this means or what's the purpose of this. Going back to like, what is the purpose of creating images like this or generating images like this? And so that's always kind of a focal point for me, is returning to those questions. I think that Nolan was talking a lot about reposting social media, not being able to verify things, and this idea of slowing down. I think the idea of moving fast, especially when it comes to social media, is really prevalent when it comes to your ability to share. You can press one button and share to hundreds, if not thousands, of people so quickly. And you know, on someone's story, all of a sudden it'll be you jumping around with someone, and then the next picture is of political candidates. And so it's very kind of back and forth, and the ability to process that in your brain, I just don't think we've really developed yet an ability to go from something really upsetting, one image, and something really happy the next. When in reality, those things are hours and hours apart from the person who posted them. But when we're viewing them on a feed or a timeline, we're seeing them seconds apart. And it's really interesting to be a part of a culture that has this constant feed of information. I think another thing that both Allison and Nolan were touching on is these events that we're talking about are really difficult. And I think students tend to retreat from these difficult things. In the conversations and the research that I'm doing currently in my dissertation, one of the things that kept coming up in the interviews I was having with students is that these conversations, even through the lens of critical media literacy, are really draining for students. They become difficult for students to constantly be inundated with bad news, something that they are almost trying to escape from. And I think when it comes to young voters and getting people interested in voting, one of the things that I'm noticing is that I think they're retreating from these events because they're difficult, because they are disturbing, because they are something that they don't want to be a part of, or that is already a part of their everyday lives with social media, which is again why well-being always comes into the centerfold for me, being able to address why are these events so important? Why are they difficult? And how can we regain momentum after you've been drained? I think being able to regain a sense of purpose and regain a sense of encouragement to be able to change these things and know that change is possible is what students need. I think the draining comes from the idea that things are permanent and that there isn't anything that they can do to change things.
Curiously, too, Sydney Sullivan, that feed, that constant feed that you referred to with all of this information being tossed at us in its really eclectic and disconnected or fractured way, it contributes to the kind of fever pitch to the political culture that we have not seemed to have left in nearly a decade or more now. Can't help but even think of going back to 9/11. Fever pitch. We've been in like crisis mode, reaction mode, fight flight mode. And we have a whole generation of people now coming through school, coming of college age. And that's the culture they've grown up in with the fractured social media landscape. I think that we need more of what you're doing as far as centering the well-being component, because I know all of us here teach. We see it in our students. We see they're beleaguered at times. And it's not because they don't have bright lights in their eyes and they don't have great ideas. They do see that there are possibilities, but it's hard to see through the fog, through the mis and disinformation, and where to jump into a conversation where there really isn't a dialogue. It's just fever pitch, and it's all the time. We're going to get the civility component of this conversation and maybe some solutions. So when we come back from another break, Sydney Sullivan, let's start with you this time and maybe continue some of that thread and see what we can get. And then we'll, of course, come back to Allison Butler and Nolan Higdon. I'd like to remind you, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the show, Crisis, Culture and Civility, the Importance of Critical Media Literacy Education on the Backdrop of Election 2024. We'll be back after this brief musical break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, we are having a stellar roundtable conversation about crisis culture and civility. We're looking at critical media literacy education as an antidote to many of the challenges we face. We're joined by Nolan Higdon, Allison Butler, and Sydney Sullivan. Sydney Sullivan, before the break, we were talking about some of the challenges of our culture and always being on. And maybe this is some of the reasons that we see in young people that they're also looking for off ramps or where to turn the knob down or where to better come into the conversation or how to start a dialogue. And a lot of your research, of course, as you've been telling us, is centered around critical media literacy education and well-being. So we're into the part of our conversation now where we're talking about civility. And not to be cynical, but I mean, it almost seems laughable to bring up civility in American politics.
You know, civility is like a formal politeness or being polite to others in formal conversation or in their behavior or speech. But I also think of just kindness and well-being. And interestingly, some of the research surrounding wellness and kindness kind of talks about it as being like a muscle, something that you have to work every day or you have to practice that. And kindness, I think a lot of times people view as an innate thing that you have. You're either a kind person or you're not a kind person, or you are able to kind of just have that essence about you. But I really view wellness and kindness and being able to engage with others with kindness as a practice, as something that you can practice and engage with on a day-to-day basis. And I think that the classroom space is a perfect place to practice that, especially when it comes to engaging with people different than us, that have different opinions, and especially different opinions that are very strongly opposed to how we believe. I think that's a perfect place to practice this idea of kindness and empathy and being able to listen intently to one another. And so I think that for me is a really big focal point for how I view the way that well-being comes into the classroom space and thinking about being able to listen to one another more intently.
Sydney Sullivan, what kind of exercises might you suggest people do? You mentioned the classroom, and of course, that's an amazing space to do this. What are some things that maybe you could do in class to get students to engage in meaningful ways around difficult issues that you think could translate outside, things that they could actually take away from an assignment and go out into the real world, so to speak?
I think there's a couple of different things, and definitely things that I've learned from that I felt like didn't work very well. And I think I've learned the most from those. One of the things I noticed right away when I first started teaching is that I would bring conversations into the classroom that I thought were relevant. And what I was missing from that was conversations that the students thought were relevant. And so as time went on, I started asking them to bring in their own materials, their own popular sources, their own kind of ideas that they felt moved by. And so that's one of the things I would suggest for any teacher, is to always be integrating your students into the picture, having those student-centered classrooms that focus on materials that they are interested in. Because even though we can research, we could guess, the easiest and like best way to do that is just to have the students come in with those. And this makes it so you're able to really have these deeper conversations, and you know that the students are passionate about it because it's something that they have contributed to the conversation.
You know, Sydney Sullivan, I couldn't help but think the brilliance of the simplicity, but yet it seems so difficult for us to do sometimes. And that's honestly or earnestly checking in with these other people that we're with and having a genuine interest and concern in what they're concerned about. And we're talking about really listening, not just lip service or not, oh yeah, okay, put that on a list, but they're actually contributing to parts of the curriculum. And then it allows you to kind of tie those things together. We don't often do that with each other in conversation, or might we say civil dialogue. Allison Butler, let's bring you in and let's talk a little bit about civility, and let's talk about some of your thoughts around this as they relate to critical media literacy education and maybe even some things that you do in the classroom.
I just really want to echo as much of everything that how valuable what Sydney was saying and this idea of well-being. And so I include myself in stuff that I've probably messed up on over the years by not paying attention. I think for a long time, probably still to this day, there was a certain level of naivete in terms of like, okay, great. I'm going to teach this media literacy stuff. I'm going to draw from my students' experiences. And that means we're all going to kind of go out into the world in a better way. And that's not true. It's not false, but it's not entirely true, because our students are coming into our classrooms with, to your point, Mickey, about just having lived in constant chaos and in constant crisis. I mean, when I think about how old my students are now, they have never not lived where things are burning. And I mean that metaphorically as well as literally. They've not had a few years of just quiet time to grow up. Everything surrounding them seems to be in crisis. And then as instructors, we might get upset that they're not being super attentive to our material. Of course they're not. They've never been invited or allowed to focus. So I think an important thing to bring into any classroom, and particularly a media literacy classroom, because it's an opportunity where we can be really meta about this kind of conversation, is here's where we're at for a certain amount of time. Let's try and focus on that certain amount of time, and let's try and model good behavior. I teach at an institution that's really large. We have nearly 25,000 undergraduates. I think one of my first responsibilities at the start of every semester is to do my hardest work to make sure that I'm calling all my students by name. When they're in a class of 400 or 500, that's not an expectation. But if they're in a class of 20 to 40, I absolutely think that is my number one thing that I should do, is start learning their names right away. They are human beings. And that's how we can begin to model civility. I think, for example, we're all doing it here. We're all talkers. All of us could talk and talk and talk. But what we're doing is we're not always talking. We're listening to what other people have to say. We're not even doing the sort of conversational interruption that can make for a wonderful dinner conversation. It's about making sure that there's time and space. And Sydney, to your point, that is a muscle. We have to constantly, constantly practice that. Maybe those of us that are talkers have to sit on our hands a little bit and say, not my turn, step back a little bit. So I think if we can try and be sort of vocally and verbally meta, like, hey, we're going to talk about this and we're going to talk about the things that we're doing with this, but then also model it and say, I got to sit back a little bit. I got to make sure that I'm just doing these behaviors and let that kind of shine through. And then notice when we do things well so that we can kind of support that. Like, for example, listening to each other. And I think if we can do that in our little pockets, in our teeny tiny little pockets, we can do a little calming of pushing back against the chaos.
There's a lot of wisdom in that, especially in the lead by example components that, you know, both that you, Allison, and Sydney were just talking about. When I see students in the classrooms, I think sometimes maybe they don't need yet another source of information blasting at them, this time just for me, even if that information is very different maybe than what they've been hearing other places. But I like what you said about learning people's names, trying to connect with people. Some of that just all ties in with slowing down. And it's like, yeah, we'll get to that. As educators, we have the agenda and the list and we've got to cover the material. It's important to remember that I think that some of the material is just us and the students and our collective experience and why we're there in the first place. It becomes part of that same noise and the chaos and the fast culture. The things that you're both telling us now, I think, are really important for people to purposefully, consciously practice and remember. And it does help to hear them. Nolan Higdon, let's bring you in here.
The crisis that our students are coming from, I think it's become so normalized, we don't focus on it enough anymore. But increasingly in this culture, pound through children, the market demands from the moment they're born all the way until they enter college. You got to get good grades, got to focus on college, got to get school, got to get the good job. That type of pressure is absurd. And I mean, Neil Postman wrote about this 30 years ago with the disappearance of childhood. We put these folks under a lot of stress. That's not saying about 9/11, terror, COVID, any of those sort of matters on top of all that. But I think we've set up a really anxious society where from kindergarten, students are feeling like their whole futures are on the line if they don't act properly in the preschool circle. So I think that's part of it. I also want to point out, and this is to all the educators out there, one thing we leads me to be very frustrated about the profession is we take the blame for everything in society. If something's wrong in the society, we blame the schools, we blame education. Well, the reverse is also not true. We can't take necessarily credit for everything. And I think we also need to reassess what is possible in the education space and what is not. It's really easy to use a lot of great rhetoric that virtue signals our values to say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Can we actually do that though? Or are we just making ourselves feel good? And I think that's an uncomfortable conversation we need to have in the education space. In terms of the classroom, I agree with what's largely been said here. Model that behavior in the classroom is critically important. But we also need to force spaces to confront difference and remind ourselves that that difference matters. There's study after study that shows just the homogeneity of ideology amongst faculty and students and schools. And we don't have to confront things or people we disagree with. And I think that's a problem if you're trying to model it in the classroom. I mean, as a teacher, we can kind of play the scapegoat or the conservative if we're in the liberal classroom or the liberal if we're in the conservative classroom. But I think students would benefit a lot more if they were forced to interact with difference and not just ideology, but poverty and race and gender. And I think we could do a better job of actually diversifying the classroom, where right now I think we diversify with the identities we can see, but we don't diversify with the ideologies or the lived experience behind them. And so I think we could do a much better job of that.
Well, and critical media literacy pedagogy gives us opportunities to do that through various forms of media in the world around us with things that are happening, not just around us, but to us, or we're part of them, right? We're not separate. The media acts as many ways as a wall, as a mirror, as a conductor, as a dictator. Our relationship to it, I think, needs to be more mindful and more deliberate. Those things have come up repeatedly. We're running up at the end of our conversation here, so I just wanted to get each of you just encapsulate maybe some things that you'd like our listeners and viewers to take away from the conversation, maybe even invite them to follow more of your work, or some of you may want to correspond with them. Nolan Higdon, Allison Butler, Sydney Sullivan. For Nolan Higdon, let's start with you for your final thoughts for the panel today.
A lot of what was said here in terms of just slowing down can be hugely important. I think having a lot more self-reflection can be hugely important as well. We spend a lot of time wagging our finger at the other side. Really good fake news and false information confirms existing bias. So I would spend a lot more time judging myself in terms of when I find content that confirms my bias. I think there's a lot more positive work that can be done there than finger wagging at others. And then in terms of the educational space, I just think it's worth reminding the audience that increasingly public spaces have been privatized. The ability to engage in such thoughtful and important work is becoming less and less possible in community spaces. And so protect schools, protect the classroom as a place where we can do this type of work. And if folks have paid attention to some of the rhetoric about education or the normalization of censorship, whether it comes from left or right in classrooms recently, we're under attack from all sides. And so I think it's critically important to be mindful of that space and protect it regardless of where you come on the ideological spectrum.
So Allison Butler.
I would absolutely echo what Nolan said about slowing down. Our current media environment really encourages us to speed up, to scroll, to zip through things really quickly, and consider that having been informed. I say we slow down. We've got to think more carefully, more slowly, and more deliberately. I would also say that it's time to start paying attention to the absence of data being data. We get a lot of information put in front of us, in front of our eyeballs, in front of our ears, at our dinner table conversations. But the more that we're getting put in front of us, we also have to recognize that there's an infinite amount more that isn't being put in front of us. What aren't we seeing? what stories aren't being told. And I'd say last but not least, this is a two-way street. I think the greatest amount of responsibility is on these systems and structures to behave better, to behave more thoughtfully, but they're only going to do that if we push them to do so. When we keep kind of buying into it, truly with our money, with our time, we are to some extent allowing them to keep doing that. So we are also responsible. It's a two-way street. They should be behaving better, and we should be educated in such a way to tell them how to behave better.
Sydney Sullivan, over to you.
Everything that Allison and Nolan said, I would definitely echo, especially when it comes to slowing down. And then what Allison was just saying about the ability to recognize missing narratives and what's not being said in a conversation. I think I would just encourage more conversations to happen, continuing to allow people to speak and listen rather than silencing or blocking people. There's a lot of data to show that our inability to contribute to dialogues or our inability to engage with others is actually harming society rather than making it better. And so I think being able to continue to be open around having conversations with others and creating those spaces for our students as well is really important.
I want to thank all of you for joining us today on the Project Censored Show for our conversation on crisis culture and civility, looking at the importance of critical media literacy education in the U.S. and, of course, globally. In the U.S., we're coming up on election 2024. And I think a lot of the things that each of you talked about today and pointed out, I think, are things that anybody or everybody listening to this, they could take something away from this. And they can improve certain parts of their lives. They can improve relationships. And, you know, something that we can always do, improve ourselves. So I want to thank all of you for being here today. Sydney Sullivan, full-time lecturer at San Diego State University. Allison Butler, senior lecturer and director of Media Literacy Certificate Program in the Department of Communications at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, also co-director at Mass Media Literacy, looking at critical media literacy for K-12 schools. And Nolan Higdon, founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, Project Censored National Judge, also lecturer at Merrill College in the Education Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. All of our guests, you'll be able to see their bios with a bunch of links to all the amazing things that they do at projectcensored.org. Thank you very much, Allison, Sydney, and Nolan, for joining today.
We want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.